note, which is no personal attacks, no outbursts, no speechifying when it's your turn to ask a question, and we will abide by the usual SEJ rules about who comes to the microphone. We got lots of people here who are not journalists always traditionally because we're a 501c3, it's an open conference, but we want working reporters and SEJ members to ask questions, and I doubt that we will get beyond that group in our questions, and we want to move through those questions really fast so we can get more in. So are we okay audio-wise? Yes? Okay. Beautiful. Very good. I want to introduce Mark Morano, and take it away, Mark.
Thank you. I actually work for Online News Service, and they weren't necessarily advocacy groups, no more than a lot of other newspapers or outlets could be called advocacy. But I also wanted one other thing, as the hoax comment that Senator Inhofe has always attributed to. He called fears of catastrophic man-made global warming a hoax, and the alarmism, referring to the media. He did not call climate change a hoax, because climate change is always happening, and it's a question. He also senators also acknowledge global warming. First of all, I want to thank the SEJ for having me here. I was going to just go through. I'm not here to try to convince anyone about the science necessarily. We're here to talk more about the media and the way they're treating this, the media labeling, the media's objectivity, balance. I don't think we'd be having this panel discussion even 1 year ago, October 2005, but I think something happened in 2006, and the senator outlined this in his 50-minute floor speech on the Senate. And we had some very, a lot of people would say, disturbing things occur in the media. One of them was Scott Pelley of 60 Minutes calling for global warming skeptics the equivalent of Holocaust deniers, and the senator pointed that out. 2006 also saw Time magazine, Be Afraid, Be Very Afraid, just an article quoting environmental defense scientists and just essentially, in the senator's view, hyping alarmism. In fact, the senator said we should be afraid of such shoddy journalism. We also had Grist magazine, which Andy Revkin, Bill Moyers, Al Gore have all used to promote their projects, come out and call for Nuremberg-style trials for climate skeptics. In addition to that, we've had several Al Gore come out and call for people global warming denialists. It's got that Holocaust ring to it when you say that. But the senator gave a speech on the floor going back 100 years, 1895, and actually goes back to 1890, roughly four different periods where the media reported on a coming ice age up until about 1930, then they worried about global warming up until about the 50s, then from the 50s to the 70s, they worried about a coming ice age, and actually an astounding development earlier this week. Newsweek magazine essentially, retraction might be a strong word, but admitted error on their famous story about the global cooling in the 1970s. And one of their quotes, of course, was, I think, pouring soot over the Arctic to help melt it so we wouldn't go into too fast of a cooling phase. But they actually came out and essentially retracted that story, which is a remarkable development. But essentially, the media this year, and you can go through point by point the Tom Brokaw special, it comes down to media labeling. Tom Brokaw spent 2 hours on Discovery Channel in July interviewing James Hansen, who's in the audience here tonight. I saw him just walk in, and Michael Oppenheimer, and had not a single skeptic. It was so bad that Bloomberg News, not some right-wing outlet, said that it was akin to a North Korean political rally in terms of there's more dissent at a North Korean political rally than in Tom Brokaw's special. Again, not Senator Inhofe's words, not mine, but that was Bloomberg News TV critic. And then the interesting thing about the Brokaw thing is they had Michael Oppenheimer say there is no skeptics that deserve any credibility because they're all bought and paid for by oil and gas interests. And in the same program, Michael Oppenheimer, I think the last salary that I saw was he had $200,000 a year almost from environmental defense, which is a environmental special interest. In addition, James Hansen, who I mentioned here, got a $250,000 grant from the Heinz Foundation in 2001. And subsequently endorsed John Kerry for president. Theresa Hines, of course, runs the Hines Foundation. But interestingly enough, Bill Blakemore, the week following Senator's speech on global warming in the media, did a special featuring Hansen and essentially mirrored all the critiques that Senator Inhofe had said. In fact, when Bill Blakemore, who's right here, in January, I believe it was January 29th, did the story about Hansen claiming censorship by the Bush administration. He failed to tell ABC World News Tonight viewers that Hansen had endorsed John Kerry and received money from Kerry's wife's foundation. Now, the question for Bill Blakemore tonight is, if Pat Michaels, let's say Pat Michaels had been the NASA scientist during the Clinton administration, and he had claimed that Bill Clinton had censored him, but Pat Michaels had endorsed Bob Dole and got money from Bob Dole's wife, do you think Bill Blakemore would have left out that inconvenient fact? I don't think so, and I'd like to hear what Bill has to say about that later. But it's a media issue. It's a labeling issue. And there's some sense that all these skeptics, Ross Gelbspan brags about, oh, Richard Lindzen got $2,500 a day from the oil and gas industry. Richard Lindzen took $10,000 in the 1990s from industry. But what about Michael Oppenheimer? What about James Hansen? What about Michael Mann, the propaganda blog RealClimate.org, set up by Environmental Media Services? There's so much money. In the 2004 election cycle, environmental special interests put in $21 million. Oil and gas put in $7 million through their PACs. In addition, when you look at all the grants that go for the federal government, I think it's $6 million a year go to a lot of the climate modelers. There is so much big money to be made in terms of environmental special interests. If you look at the operating budgets, I think it's Sierra Club is $91 million annual as of 2004. Natural Resources Defense Council might be $71 million. CEI, the most vilified because they got some industry funding, gets $3.6 million. So where is all this money? And you could argue, you don't have to argue that oil and gas is even that small, but the point is there's no fairness in labeling. When you have CNN's Miles O'Brien say all the skeptics are bought and paid for by oil and gas, and then he puts on, again, James Hansen. I have a feeling James Hansen's going to want to ask a question or make a statement here because I've mentioned him so many times. But again, taking the money from that, I can't imagine a skeptic working for the administration, scientific skeptic, taking money from someone and then endorsing a candidate and then claiming censorship. And again, Bill Blakemore, Miles O'Brien not reporting that when they report on that scientist. It's just fairness. I'm not here to impugn their integrity. I'm here to say if you're going to label, label fairly. I'm not saying don't label skeptics if they receive money, but I'm saying if you are going to label, label the other side. And for that, the only other thing I'd want to mention is, the senator lays out the science in his speech. We have booklets over by the door. Excuse me. It's called Hot and Spin. What is it called? Hot and Cold Media Spin Cycle. It's got his 6,000-plus text of the Senator Inhofe's speech. It also has some recent updates. And there's a lot of fascinating stuff. One of the things that no one's reported on, and I would like to know if, Andy, you're planning on reporting on this, is Claude Allègre, a French scientist who came out and was an absolute climate alarmist, for lack of a better word. Again, that's a label, but for lack of a better word. And now he's a climate skeptic and actually accused environmentalists of making a lot of money hyping fear. That's a big story. If that were the other way around, somehow I think other members on this panel would be covering that. So all my main point here today is not to get into the science, not to get into all the arguments, but it's about media fairness and media labeling, and it's just, I think there's a very myopic view among many journalists. And I will say that I consider Andrew Revkin, by the way, reported on Hansen's grant of $250,000, his endorsement. Andrew Revkin doesn't get into the labeling of the skeptics like, say, Bill Blakemore or Scott Pelley or Miles O'Brien from CNN would. And with that, I don't know if I've used up my time, but I think I've probably said enough for some people. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. I'm going to start with Dan, and then we'll move along.
Okay. Thank you, Christy. I think I'll let Bill and Andy respond directly to the attacks on them. They are more better off answering for themselves. But I do think that I'm here because I can supply a slightly different perspective. I was 20 years in the trenches writing about environmental issues, including warming. Now I'm at a different perch in academia for my journalism. With distance comes some clarity, and it also brings some freedom, and it allows you to speak freely without the constraints that come from working for big media. And God knows that is especially important on an issue like this, especially this particular panel. So I don't want to talk about science, but I do think that science has to drive this issue. Science is at the heart of this topic, and it's also at the heart of this controversy over whether the coverage has been fair. So, Mark, you're asking them questions. I have some questions for you. Can we agree that the greenhouse effect is real and that without it we're an ice ball? That's settled science. Can we agree that CO2 is a very important greenhouse forcing gas and it has a discernible impact on climate? That is a settled scientific issue. We have overwhelming evidence of that. Can we agree that atmospheric CO2 levels have never been this high, at least in the past 25 million years? We have very solid evidence of this. Worldwide temperature. Can we agree that worldwide average temperature hasn't been this high in hundreds of years? And according to the NAS, contrary to what you would read if you looked at Senator Inhofe's speech that he delivered in the well of the Senate, the NAS agreed with Mike Mann, and they said that there's a 2-to-1 probability that indeed temperatures are higher now than they have been in the last millennium. Can we agree on that? These are facts. Everyone is entitled to their own opinions, but everyone is not entitled to their own facts. So when Senator Inhofe says that the NAS has repudiated Michael Mann's hockey stick, that is false. And I don't know if he did it knowingly or not, but if he did it knowingly, I can say now from my academic perch, that is a lie if he did it knowingly. And it should be called a lie if indeed he did it knowingly. Furthermore, if you are giving a speech or if you're writing a news story and you give the views of an economist or a minerals exploration consultant or other non-climatologists, if you weight their views anywhere nearly close to equally as those of trained climatologists, people who spend their scientific careers understanding the pursuit of climate, if you make that mistake of giving them anywhere near equal weight, as Senator Inhofe does, you are telling a different kind of lie. It's a different kind of lie, but it's a lie nonetheless because it's a perversion of the scientific process. These kinds of issues are at the heart of the media critique that we hear from Senator Inhofe. You don't go to an oncologist if you have a bunion, and you don't go to a podiatrist if you've got lymphoma. And if you want to know about climate, you go to a climatologist. That's the way science works. Furthermore, when you do go to a climatologist, you need to understand that if your climate, the climatologist that you talk to, that you include in your speech on the Senate floor, or if you include in your news story, is someone who either believes that A, global warming is not occurring, or B, that humans do not have a discernible, human activity does not have a discernible impact on climate, then you need to understand that person's view represents an overwhelming minority. And if you, in your speech, give it equal weight or anywhere remotely equal weight, you are being deliberately misleading. Well, I don't know about deliberately, but you are being fundamentally misleading. That is wrong, and that is a perversion of science, and that matters. So, Mark, for every John Christie or Richard Lindzen, we know that there are 200, 500, 1,000 climatologists who represent the consensus view of science. And consensus is not a word that is tossed around lightly in science. Consensus is hard won. It's hard won. It means something when it occurs. I read Senator Inhofe's speech at the time, maybe because I'm from his home state. But for whatever reason, I read it. And I did find one line that I agreed with, and it was the line when the senator said, quote, "I don't have any journalistic training." So, yes, Senator, I believe that that's correct. And the reason I think that it's right is that he did get one thing right. He points out that there is a bias in journalism. I agree that there is a bias, but it is a fundamentally different bias than the one that Senator Inhofe thinks exists. The bias that we have in journalism is a desperate search for quote-unquote balance, even when the evidence is not balanced. We also have a craving for conflict because we think that our readers like conflict, and we crave it even in areas where the data suggests that there is no legitimate conflict. So how do you advance your career as a journalist? Well, you don't do it by articulating the conventional wisdom. You do it by going against the grain, by amplifying the lone voice crying out against the establishment. And by the way, that's true for young scientists as well. You don't get published in Science or Nature or PANS by simply amplifying the existing views about climate change. No, the way to make a splash and to build your career is to find something new and say it. And if that goes against the conventional wisdom, well, then your career is made. your career is made. So all of these factors, the phony balance problem, the craving for conflict, the desire to go against the grain, they do bias stories, but in exactly the opposite way that Senator Inhofe says. But now this is changing. You don't see a lot of journalism anymore promoting the claims of skeptics, even though it would help the careers of those journalists if they did it. And it's been years since we've seen any peer-reviewed science from skeptics, even though you could really make a splash in the scientific community if you could make a scientifically credible argument questioning a human contribution toward climate science. Why don't you see that? Well, because the data is pouring in, and because journalists and scientists, unlike U.S. senators or political operatives, we are reality constrained. We're constrained by the facts. We have to operate under that terrible burden. Science figured out long ago the reality of climate change, and now the media is catching up. And that's bad news for Senator Inhofe because he has profited. He and his ilk have profited from the structural biases in journalism. So that leads to the final point. Why is Senator Inhofe doing this? Well, it seems like he doesn't really have any other choice. When you're confronted, history tells us that when you're confronted with overwhelming evidence, you have three choices. You can just give in. You can make a case on the merits. That's not possible in this case. Or you can promote a big lie strategy, where you just keep insisting that something is true, even in the face of overwhelming evidence to the contrary. And if you keep insisting on it, and if your assertion is sweeping enough, then people, a certain percentage of people are going to believe it, especially if they're already ideologically inclined to do so. And the reason they'll believe it is because they'll say, my God, that is the most audacious thing I've ever heard. There's got to be something to this, or he wouldn't be saying it. And that is a tried and true strategy, but it is a short-term strategy. People have tried it. Joe McCarthy tried it. George Wallace tried it. The leaders of the People's Republic of China tried it.
You may be hearing a speech about this pretty soon.
This occurs both on the right and the left. Certainly the leaders of communist China thought that they could pull this off.
So now Inhofe is communist China here?
So the big lie, the point is, Mark, and it's a serious one, is that the big lie technique works for a while, but eventually it falls under its own weight. And that's what's happening. It's already happening, and it will continue to happen.
Mark, I will give you a rebuttal moment after we go through everybody.
Sure. I'm done, by the way.
Okay. And I figured.
Finished.
And I'm going to go to Bill Blakemore, but I just want to throw out my observation about why I think the senator is doing this now, and that is because the 50-50 equivalence has begun to disappear from media coverage. I mean, it's essentially what you said yourself. I think what's happened is, and we've talked about it in one of our sessions today, that the consensus is in, and reporters who cover this issue are no longer giving equal weight or generally equal weight now to the climate skeptics, and I wouldn't be surprised if that's part of the reason why Senator Inhofe responded as he did, because that has been changing. But just mull that over while we let Bill Blakemore go next.
Thanks. Well, I'm a professional skeptic and have been for more than 30 years now. A skeptic is someone who keeps asking questions, not a cynic, not a Pollyanna. So I'm delighted by this conversation. I discovered the globe.
Here, mine works. Take mine.
All right. I discovered the global warming story only about 2 years ago. I now realize, spun by the fact that I'd been listening about 10 years ago to a very respected, then respected hurricane scientist who said, oh, there's nothing in it. It's nonsense. And I was covering other things. And then I discovered it by accident. With a conversation that I had with a scientist I'd worked on an extinction story 10 years before. I said, why did all the frogs disappear? Do you know yet? And he said, it's global warming. I said, you got to be kidding me. And he directed me to three different studies of other studies. Not one, but three meta studies. And I looked at all of them. They were all in Nature. And I said, oh, my goodness, it feels like there's something here. And I started looking into the story. That was 2 years ago. And I rather quickly found that my journalistic instincts were telling me there was an astonishing story here, and within a few months, having looked into it deeply, I decided that there was a massive gap, that we had been well spun, we, the general mainstream professional journalists in the United States, by, among other things, a disinformation campaign that had been documented by people like Ross Gelbspan and Chris Mooney and others, and I started looking into what they were doing, constantly skeptical. As I remain now, I'm always turning over rocks and looking for things. And in Mark Morano's comments, I've already heard the sound of possibly yet another story we've got to do about hyping fear. It's a good story to do. There will be profiteering. There already is. That's a great story, too. Anyway, I came to realize that there was that we were way behind here, and I began to ask, why have we been so successfully spun for so long? We need to become much more skeptical. And as has been referred to here, I started analyzing what it was about. And one of the reasons, of course, was not only the psychological factors. This is a very difficult, problematic, frightening story to think about. Any journalist who covers it goes through their own periods of, you know, semi-depression. You call up other people covering it for mutual therapy sometimes. But also that it had been quite politicized. I realized immediately that this is not a politics story, though it's a story of enormous political importance. It's a political issue that looks like it's as important as anyone would be. But it had been politicized, and it was not about politics. It wasn't a politics story. It was an event story. When Mount St. Helens blew up, we didn't give the other side equal time. We didn't give them much time at all. And I said, could it be that this is an event as blatant as that? And so I started asking that question and calling up scientists all over the world, figuring out ways to get out into the field and talk to them there and do my homework. And I kept finding, oh, my goodness, we're way behind on this story. Now, of course, one of the other things that I found that whom the people I'd come to understand as spinners were doing was taking advantage of a misunderstanding about the nature of science. Science never deals in absolute proof or absolute truth. It's not the nature of it, as any basic philosophy of science course will teach you. And I found that people I call the spinners were saying, well, they're not sure yet, and so we have to wait. And, of course, there was, as is, was used in the now well-documented tobacco story, well, we've got to let the scientists argue it out among themselves, to which the answer is, no, we don't. Don't tell me how to do my job. I am a professional journalist. I will work hard, stand on what I decide is the right thing to report. And I'm very proud to work for a serious professional journalistic organization, ABC News. To be a journalist means you want to be edited. And so I started looking into it myself and saying, my goodness gracious, and suggesting to my bosses 2 years ago, and you know, we all have 20 bosses who work at big organizations, didn't get a lot of response right away except, you've got some convincing to do. So I started doing it, pitching stories. And one of the first stories I decided to pitch was one I'd been covering for 15 years, which was the mass extinction phenomenon going on around the planet. Now that it was being connected to global warming, I, who have been trying to get the sixth extinction on the air for more than 3 decades, thought, maybe the global warming story will make the extinction story more important. Ironically, because first, of course, it was going to be the other way around, and that's the way it's turned out. I put together a trip down to Costa Rica to redo our story 10 years later about extinctions around the planet connected to global warming this time, basing it in the Monteverde Cloud Forest. And 10 days before I was about to leave, Michael Crichton's book came out. I looked at it and said, oh, my goodness, if this guy's right, I shouldn't be wasting ABC's money. And I photocopied all of the nonfiction entries at the back end of his book. Didn't read the novel itself, but read all the nonfiction claims. Every line of his 20-page bibliography, wondered about this and that. I'd read some of those articles. I didn't know if I agreed. Faxed those pages to 4 different scientists, some in England, some here, got their responses. Even before I came back, I'd already discovered that Michael Crichton's explanations at the back end of the book struck me as being self-contradictory and empty. I couldn't quite figure out what he was really trying to do. Forgive this moment of humor. My favorite review of his book was a New York Times reviewer, I think, who said that they found that the novel itself was such a poor excuse for a potboiler that perhaps he put all of this nonfiction stuff at the end of the book as an excuse for having written not a great potboiler. I don't know. I don't want to get ad hominem about this, but my point was I did my homework for many months. I looked into every single criticism, everything that came out from the deniers, from Patrick Michaels. I can easily answer the Patrick Michaels question that you asked. And for months and months, I kept doing that. I heard somebody say, you know, of course, you've got to listen to all the criticism, as I listened to all of these other scientists, the good scientists. Camille Parmesan, the good economists working on it, Gary Yeo. I called up and met James Hansen, Walter O. Schell, people who now we talk to all the time about this, Richard Somerville, Michael Oppenheimer, and I discovered that the good ones were saying, of course, you've got to always listen to the criticism, but we all know we're professional journalists. What you do is you listen to the criticism, but you also have to judge it. And so I spent months and I kept doubting myself. I still do. If you're a good journalist, you always wake up and say, I can't be right about that. That can't be right. And I kept deciding that I was going to judge for myself about the scientists. But I'm not a scientist, never will be. And so I started looking for people who were expert. First of all, I talked to our terrific polling unit at ABC about finding opinions among scientists and what the real consensus is. And then I talked with him about it, and then I started looking for experts in assessing the opinions of scientists about scientific issues and found, for example, Granger Morgan, who has developed an interesting process for doing this at Carnegie Mellon University. Because I realized that one of my first responsibilities here was going to be reporting responsibly on the vast, on the scientific consensus, whatever it might be. And I kept questioning it and doubting it. I had the advantage of coming in late as a skeptic to the story. The way science works is by scientists coming up with new ideas that they put in refutable form. That means you can imagine how to refute it. And then in spite of all attempts by the other scientists to refute it, you fail. Similar to the way professional journalism works. We're all biased. All communication is biased. And what a professional journalist as opposed to a propagandist does is be open about his biases and then constantly put them to the test. I'm doing it this minute. I'm constantly wondering, can this be possibly right? You know, you all hope that somebody, some scientist is going to come forward who has any credibility among other scientists and say this isn't right, because that would be wonderful. But after a long time of covering the story, you know, 2 years, I now understand that's mostly wishful thinking now, but I always listen. I can now, having done a lot of my homework on deniers, usually tell within 20 minutes. Or much less, I mean, sometimes even 20 seconds, I look at, oh, I've heard that before, I've heard before, I've checked that out 3 times. Now, I'm probably out of time, so let me just summarize it by this. And I mean, I'll answer the Patrick Michael question in a moment, but let me just make this point. I think in general, there's a lot of understandable and initially forgivable reasons that mainstream media in America has missed it on this story and let ourselves be spun yet once again with the same tactics that tobacco used. This is a much more complicated and frightening story than tobacco in terms of what the mainstream conservative scientists are telling us. I mean, I found such things as the National Academy of Sciences of all of the G8 countries plus 3 others agreeing on a consensus that took 40 years to create. They are telling us that there are serious frightening things that are hard to think about. We've got to take it in small doses. And so I realized that as a professional scientist, as a professional journalist, I was going to be reporting on what I believe, or rather to put the emphasis in the correct place, on what I believe the scientific consensus is, and that I would be making my own assessments of when naysayers were something close to the proverbial flat earth society, when they had anything, and boy, do I look for somebody who will. And that I would try to report on this story in a way that got out of the politicized fallacy. The story was so horrendously politicized when I found it that there was noise all over the place. And so I just said, I'm going to start checking it out with as wide a variety of scientists as I can. The politicization was causing a lot of journalistic fog. Now, that's basically my answer to your Patrick Michaels question, if I understood it correctly. I'm happy to go over it again lately. I checked out James Hansen before doing stories on him. I talked to a lot of other scientists about him before doing stories on him. I went and looked at what he had said in 1988 and before, and I talked to Steve Schneider about him and got from Steve Schneider his explanation of why they got the aerosols thing wrong, so the ice age thing was wrong. But science is self-correcting in some ways. And I finally felt it was right and responsible to do stories about James Hansen. I did not get the same response when I tried to check out what Patrick Michaels was saying. I checked it out with a number of different people and read it myself. It was my personal decision to propose to my editors that this was the right way to put this on the air and now on our webpage. They gave me good, tough editorial questions. I answered them. And we, with a great deal of editing, went on the air. That's my basic approach as a professional.
Well, just, I'm sorry to insert here, but the question really was, you had Pat Michaels accusing Bush of censorship but made no mention, as Andrew Revkin did in the New York Times, mentioned that he got money from Heinz and endorsed John Kerry for president. Would you have, if you were reporting on Pat Michaels against Clinton in a similar situation, would you report that Pat Michaels endorsed Kerry? I think you could have afforded one sentence. I think you can tell this audience. I think, can I see a show of hands here? You understand the situation. How many think he should have at least put one sentence that the big scientist accusing Bush of censorship has endorsed Bush's political opponent? Do you think that's relevant for one sentence in an ABC News story? How many hands? One, two, three. Oh, come on. One, two. Very few hands. All right, well, there's your
this
answer.
Do
you have an answer?
I think the question you just posed is politicizing and avoiding what I'm trying to talk about,
this
which
is
the
labeling,
serious...
No,
no, but I disagree with you on that.
Well, answer the question, though. Would you ever...
The reason the question is not answerable is because there are many. If we had a story that was essentially about all of that, of course,
it's not relevant that the scientist accusing Bush of censorship endorsed his political opponent.
I would have to go
$250,000. I think you'd be all over it if it was Richard Lindzen, Pat Michaels, and you know you would be all over it.
I'm sorry.
I think you guys know it too.
No.
Come on.
No, may I take?
I'm
the
done. I'm done.
No.
I checked him out.
Not about that. It's about labeling.
I want to go to Andy Revkin and Mark. I do want to give you a chance to respond in full. Well, Andy, you want to go?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
So, gee whiz, this is, you know what this is all about. I've been thinking about this for 20 years or something now. I got to take this thing out of here. All right, here we go. A huge part of what's going on here is a lack of a consistent definition of what we're talking about. You know, if the question is catastrophic global warming happening, which some people have said is happening. I don't mean in 100 years scale. I mean now. There would be a lot of people who would agree with what Senator Inhofe has said in that speech. If the question is, if you define global warming as, is there greenhouse forest warming of the climate happening? It's a totally different question. But in our argument over this and in the way the media have kind of portrayed this issue this past year or so, frankly, we've handed a lot of red meat to Senator Inhofe. There's legitimate problems that I have with the way a lot of media have covered the issue of late. Because the notion that for example, I'm going to draw a curve here just to show you. I'm going to be scientific. I just gave a talk at West Virginia University on the media and climate and had this mini epiphany. Every idea out there is a curve, okay? The consensus is this stuff. The hot voices are all out here. I don't know if you in the back can see. Bell curve, consensus middle, okay? We could make one. Get the idea? And for years on this issue, the media was always focusing, as we always do on any story, on the voices on the edges of the curve, and which totally eliminates the idea that there's a consensus. It's ignored completely. And even now, like you look back at what Richard Lindzen wrote in the Wall Street Journal in April about climate alarmism, he said, down in the fine print, he said he agrees that carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas. More of it will warm the world. He just doesn't see the trend so far as a catastrophe. So in all of this coverage and in all of the heat here, which is perfectly fine. I mean, Mark is a partisan. Hello, you know, that's a label. That's fine. And I, you know, I won't say. Well, he does his job very effectively, and has for a long time. And that is his job. And Senator Inhofe is a partisan. He's got a point of view that he's trying to justify with things out there, and science will give everybody in the room all the studies they will ever need to justify an opinion. And that is one of the big disconnects here that creates a lot of this business. But I want to get back. I think if there's one thing, and I'm going to be a little fragmented here because I've been working on a story all day. If there's one take-home message that I think we all could try to do is come away with a definition each day you're writing on global warming. What aspect of it are you writing on? Are you writing on, is greenhouse forcing happening? Absolutely, positively, there's a consensus. In fact, if you were to do a curve of that idea, It would look like this. Okay, you get the idea? So natural selection, big bang, right? Very narrow curve. But there's still plenty of voices out here, always. So it can be portrayed either way. It's a debate, you know. It's kind of equivalent. Look at that. There's yay-sayers and naysayers. Guess Big Bang, well, there was George Deutsch who wanted to make sure we knew the Big Bang was only a theory. Remember earlier this year? So think about that. And I think what's happened with global warming of late is that the media, after ignoring it for so long because it's a he says, she says thing, have suddenly decided that maybe it's a guilt thing here going on or something, that now it's absolutely positively be worried, be very worried. And it's happening now, and every aspect of it has no debate anymore. And that is not the case. If you draw the curve for what we understand about whether hurricanes are already forced by greenhouse gas accumulation, it's like this. It's a shallow curve, okay? And you can tell that because of the papers coming out in peer-reviewed literature on whether hurricanes have already been juiced up by us. They're like this, like windshield wiper, whiplash findings. Greenland, just think of the papers in the last month or two on Greenland, whether it's gaining or losing ice. Now we know it's definitely losing ice, but there was a paper just last week, two weeks ago, that said it's losing ice, 150 cubic, whatever it was, kilometers. And then Jay Zwally's paper came out and said it's losing ice, but it's one-third of that. And so, and every time, you look at especially the UK press, but a lot of us too, take each one of those little punctuation marks and make it into God's truth. And then the reader comes away saying, what do I know? These people don't know anything. Instead of saying, in our stories, try to suss out. If you're writing about abrupt climate change, it's a very shallow curve also. If you're writing about, you know, what the world's going to look like in 100 years with two or three times the concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, that's another one of these penile kind of, you know, very sharp points, okay? There's no dispute. Pat Michaels, I interviewed him in 2003. You can look up the story. He said his best projection, Patrick Michaels, who on his website, at the top of his company's website, says advocacy science. Advocacy science. What is that? Okay. At any rate, even Pat Michaels has calculated that we're going to see about 3 degrees of warming from a doubling of greenhouse gases. Guess what? Pat Michaels is well within the IPCC range now. So again, there's no debate at all on the long-term picture. But the uncomfortable reality for us in the newsroom is that's still not a page one story. The long-term picture is not a page one story, and we're so eager. We are, because of that search for the front page thought to finally come up with that little way to get this story on the front page. And even the New York Times, we fell into that trap in 2000, as the senator cited, when a reporter, while I was on vacation... In fact, guess it was the same week. I had a front page story for sure on Jim Hansen finally coming through with the idea that soot was a significant contributor to climate. And if you cut out soot, which you could do really quickly, that would really be a nice, good way to start on solving the climate problem. I thought that was a front page story. It got bumped from the front page while I was on vacation by an account from two scientists, neither of whom is a climatologist or an sea ice expert, came back from a Russian nuclear icebreaker cruise and said, there's open water at the North Pole. And that was a front page story because it was a sleepy Friday afternoon and it had a really good picture of the bow of the boat and water, you know, with ice around it. And it was like half of the front page that day. And it was a horrifying thing. As soon as I saw it, I was, oh my God. Because, of course, anyone who has actually been to the North Pole, read the book. The best endorsement of this came a few weeks ago on the Senate floor. And Mark recently said on the BBC, it's the least bad book out there, I think, or something like that, on climate change. At any rate, but it's written for people 10 and up, which means even elected officials can understand it. It has pictures. Anyway, we are predisposed. The trap is set. The mouse trap is all ready for us to screw up. You know, because there will be these things. There will be these Katrinas, and then guess what? There's a year without hurricanes. And there will be open water at the North Pole. And it's very important, when the curve suddenly looks like a spike, it's all the more important to just turn up your own radar, turn up your own skepticometer a little bit more, and call a few extra people and just try to suss it out. Otherwise, we will end up giving more red meat to people like Senator Inhofe. I'll stop there.
Thank you. Mark, everybody went long but you. You kept to your 5 minutes. Okay. So I'm giving you another 5 minutes, and then we're going to open
right,
it up
well,
to you guys.
Well, first of all, very compelling arguments they're made by Andy Revkin. I wish Bill Blakemore, Miles O'Brien, who I understand won an award here earlier this week, would take note of what Andrew Revkin was just saying. Actually, and the senators made a note of this. This alarmism that's hyping. And let me read you a quote from Bob Carter, the paleoclimate geologist from James Cook University in Australia. He talks about it's actually what a British group called the Institute for Public Policy Research, a labor-leaning, left-wing, for lack of a better word, group in England, which calls it climate porn, which is what they call the media, all these stories you see. And I'm not talking about necessarily a documentary, but I'm talking about those stories every other day. Global warming could do this. Global warming could do that. He says, quote, each such alarmist article is larded with such words as if, might, could, probably, perhaps, expected, projected, or modeled, and many involve such deep dreaming or ignorance of scientific facts and principles that they are akin to nonsense, unquote. And I think what's happening, and I think you guys need to realize it, and maybe you won't want to take it because I am a partisan, as Andy says. You know, I work for GOP Senator Senator Inhofe, is you are doing yourself a disservice. If I was advising you on the outside, and I would say if you want to convince the American people, it's not to go the route of Bill Blakemore and label all the skeptics as industry funded. And actually, Bill Blakemore, geez, beyond that, he actually said, after extensive searches, ABC News has found no such debate. Let me repeat that. No such debate. He doesn't even acknowledge any debate now as of August 30th, 2006. I don't know if you're willing to retract that statement tonight and join Newsweek with their retraction from the 70s. But when you have that kind of reporting and you have, and your story was, will the children be harmed and the impacts, it's at some point people are just tuning you out. And we actually cite in the senator's speech, he cited a Pew Center poll from July, which showed that the country's roughly split between people who think it's natural climate change or man-made. Los Angeles Times poll showed that I think it was a 50% increase in people who are growing more skeptical. I mean, don't you? And Andy hit the point on the head. You're doing yourself a disservice in addition to doing bad journalism. And by the way, Dan, I can't let it go unsaid. You said something about the hockey stick not being broken. You can look this up. National Academy of Sciences said the claim that the 90s were the hottest decade was unsupportable. Look it up. Look, go to our website, epw.senate.gov. You will find that there. And the other question is, it's not about is greenhouse gas, and that's in Seth Bornstein, unfortunately, is not here, but his story about scientists give Gore two thumbs up. Obviously, there's a greenhouse gas effect, but there's also other factors, and that's what people, the skeptics, so to speak, talk about. There's other influences, solar, ocean, volcanoes, urbanization, land use changes, aerosols. I mean, there's so many other things. It's not just if greenhouse gas is equals that. Richard Lindzen actually explained it about the stabilizing effect of greenhouse gases, that if you have a window, you paint it black, first coat of paint is going to be a huge impact on the light coming to the window. Each successive coat of paint has less and less of an impact, and that's what a lot of the skeptics, including Pat Michaels and other skeptics, say. We have in here the letter from the 60 scientists who wrote Prime Minister Harper in Canada. In this book, we actually go through a lot of other science on this. To reduce this down to painting your opponents, if I will say that, because you guys are coming across as advocates, your opponents, as stooges of oil and gas, is flies in the face of the facts. As I've already gone through the numbers, when Senator Inhofe is asked how much money he gets from oil and gas, his simple answer is not enough when you consider how much environmental special interest. The man's unapologetic, and frankly, he's right. And I don't just say that as a partisan. I mean, you look at the money. It's not about, you don't have to believe that all the scientists are bought out by environmental special interest, but you can't believe the other way either, that all scientists are bought out by industry. It's wrong. It's completely embarrassing for Miles O'Brien to say that. It's completely embarrassing for Tom Brokaw to have, of all people, Michael Oppenheimer make the charge. I mean, it's flies in the face. The American people aren't stupid. I can't remember. I think Bill Blakemore said that either this morning or not. They're not stupid, and they see right through it, and you're hurting yourselves if you really believe what you supposedly believe, that it's catastrophic and we're all going to die. And also, in terms of predictions, if you want to have a good laugh, look at the Earth Day predictions from 1970. Environmental predictions have a history of being laughable, embarrassing, whether you're talking about Jacques Cousteau saying the oceans will be dead, whether you're talking about the population bomb, whether you're talking about resource scarcity. I mean, environmental predictions are made to be made fun of. Coming ice age scares, and environmental alarmist predictions, I want to say, not environmental predictions. And so when you look at this now and you hear that just ratcheted up, it seems like every other week, and you know, and to mention James Hansen again, he seems to be the media darling on this. He's on there almost every other week. You know, how bad could it be? How bad is this? Richard Lindzen, I think, said it best. He said he's never seen so much hoopla about a tenth of a degree in the history of man, you know, whether this year was this degree or not. Bottom line is we're coming out of a little ice age. So, yeah, we had warming in the 20th century. Some would argue that the alarmist, so to speak, the climate alarmist, latched onto this in the 70s and because it was cooling after 1940, after a huge increase in CO2, by the way, from 40 to the mid-70s, and they trumpeted a coming ice age. Well, then that ended up not working out, so now they're jumping on this because we're naturally warming from the last ice age. It's not a shock to say temperatures are warmer now than they were 400 years ago. There's also the efforts to get rid of the medieval warm period. You just got to have an open mind on this. It's not as simple as the consensus. And I will leave you with one thought before we go to questions. When you do a story quoting James Hansen, when you do a story with some researcher, the so-called climate porn, for lack of a better word, I'm not necessarily accusing Hansen of the climate porn. I'm just saying when you do these stories that come out all the time, I would suggest you call your local state climatologist or your local AMS-certified, American Meteorological-certified weathermen, TV weathermen. I'm not saying you call them to respond to a specific study. I'm saying if you're going to do a study saying, my God, the sky is falling, Earth's ending, how about 1 to 2 sentences at the bottom of your article saying, but so-and-so meteorologist, you know, says that you need to keep this in perspective or does not subscribe to this. In fact, the reporter who was here from Minneapolis said he did a whole series on global warming and pretty alarming stories. And 2 out of the 3 Minneapolis weathermen, or meteorologists, did not agree with it. Is a hit piece on Senator Inhofe.
We should
Inhofe.
Just all go home then, I guess.
No. We have a hit piece on Senator Inhofe in Oklahoma, and after they did the piece, they went to their certain meteorologist who then said he didn't agree with the piece and said there was a coming ice age scare in the 70s. So my point to you is, if you look at state climatologists, if you look at the meteorologists, the further you get away from the publicity, grant-seeking, computer modelers on this, you're going to be surprised to find the alarmism fades and the skepticism grows. If nothing else, please check out our website, epw.senate.gov, majority, and hopefully it'll be majority after the election as well. But please check that out because it's a repository of information, and I think it's legitimate information, and you shouldn't just demonize it. And I still haven't heard anyone comment on what Scott Pelley said about Holocaust deniers, about Nuremberg trials. Everyone just seems to want to gloss over that. I mean, these are your people. They're saying this stuff, and no one's saying anything about that. So.
Mark, I want to start the questioning with Seth's question. And because you didn't really talk about his story, I'm not going to read his statement just in the interest of time.
Yeah, I feel bad he's not here. I didn't want to.
It's okay. I mean, we might put, if he wants, we can put it up on the website. He's listening. All right.
Oh, he's right there. Okay. Hello,
but,
Seth.
I'm going to ask Seth's question, actually, because it deals with something you brought up. And then I have questions from the floor. And we all have hard out times, so we just can't go too much over. We're going to go a little over. Here's the question. In a June 27th press release attacking the AP story, Senator Inhofe and Mr. Morano said this. This is Seth's story, but this is a quote from you. Last week's National Academy of Sciences report dispelled man's often cited claims by reaffirming the existence of both the medieval warm period and the Little Ice Age. And on June 22nd, an Inhofe press release said, quote, today's NAS report reaffirms what I've been saying all along, that man's hockey stick is broken. But now back to Seth. But this is not what the NAS study said, which found that there was not enough evidence before 1600, but it concluded, quote, the committee finds it plausible that the Northern Hemisphere was warmer during the last few decades of the 20th century than during any comparable period over the preceding millennium. It's from page 4 of the summary.
Science is now plausible. That's it. If they find it plausible, that means what?
That's right, Mark. That's the way science.
Car accident leaving today.
Well, of course, Mark, but we never have perfect certainty in science.
Actually, I got to weigh in. I'm going to weigh in on the hockey stick very quickly. Michael Mann, if anyone reads his paper that this was all about, it never said any of this. All of the attacks, and actually that whole, even the Academy report missed the point, which was, and I asked them about it, which was the paper never said it. It was huge. It was full of caveats. Even the title of the paper was full of caveats. So the whole thing is a whole red, the entire question is a whole red herring. The hockey stick got turned into an icon by others, the IPCC process, which there are many legitimate questions about how that works. End of period.
And just want to repeat again, the National Academy of Sciences said the claim that the 90s were the hottest decade was unsupportable. Ergo, you could argue the hockey stick's broken. And again, you're picking on rhetorical flourish, the word broken, but they said the word it was unsupportable. What's the question? Is that Seth's question?
The chair.
The question was, can you reconcile what is a large gap between what the NAS report actually said and what the senator said the NAS report said?
I mean, I think we've already addressed it. They said it was unsupportable. Look at the facts. Go back and look at the report.
Here's what the chair of the committee said.
That's what he said in a press conference. Yeah, what is that? That doesn't mean anything.
He's the chair of the...
Well, what about the report?
Mark.
We're quoting from the report.
Give me a break.
That's the whole point, is they do a study, they put it in writing, and then they go spin it to the media. Absolutely. So I'm going by the report.
This
you're going by what he said in the press conference. Go ahead.
David, this Gerald North is not a climate alarmist. He's a mainstream climatologist. He says we roughly agree with the substance of their findings. It's carefully couched, the way that scientists speak. He says, in particular, the committee has, quote, a high level of confidence, unquote, that the second half of the 20th century was warmer than any other period of the past four centuries.
Okay, right.
That's
what okay.
He says.
Pause. And the past four centuries.
Well,
that we were in a little ice age. That is the most non.
Let me hasten to add, Mark. Statement. Overall, the committee thought that the temperature reconstructions from that earlier era had only a 2-to-1 chance of being right. In other words, sure, there's a possibility that the medieval period was warmer. But it's a likelihood that it was not. That's the consensus view of the NAS. I'm sorry that we can't present that as certainty, but that's not the way science works.
We link to the report. In effect, all the press releases that you and Seth are talking about, we say the 90, it's unsupportable. We link to the report. We have all that available on our website. In the speech, we link to the stuff. On
2-to-1 probability, Mark.
Okay, let's move on. Joe?
It is.
You're up. Just identify yourself, please. Get real close.
Well, you try the other mic, Joe.
Not working. Yes.
He's already out of time. Okay, here we go. I guess my question for Mark is one of those, how do you answer those who say that questions? I want to start with like two examples, and then I'll deliver the question. One is on your press release on Seth Bornstein's article.
Yes.
In which you said, well, one of the big critiques you made, one of the small critiques was, oh, well, he claims to have so many, I guess it's about 20 scientists, but he only names, what, five of them.
I think it was five.
And that's
six.
A big flaw in Seth's story. But your own press release did the exact same thing, saying, well, you had 20 scientists on the other side, but you only named four or five
of them. Well, we have the 60 scientists.
Now, let me finish the question, please.
Sure.
And you've even tonight talked about articles, that are critical of Senator Inhofe as hit pieces, and yet you criticize others for labeling. And I guess my question is, aren't you asking others to play by rules that you yourself refuse to abide by?
Good question.
And do you think this is fair? Are you really entitled to ignore the rules that you ask other people to play by?
We're a GOP press office, and this is the media. So first of all, when we do a story like that, what Seth Bornstein did, I don't even say the comparison, but what Seth Bornstein did, he contacted over 100 scientists, 19 saw the movie, and I think he quoted five, if I have my numbers right. The problem is that's like saying Senator Inhofe gave a Senate floor speech. Our office called 50 climate scientists, but only 18 skeptics saw it, and they all give it. Scientists give Inhofe two thumbs up for accuracy. Bornstein cannot be proud of that article. I don't want to dwell on it because he's not here. Although hi Seth, he's on the phone over there. They're holding it up. But I mean, he can't be proud of that article. It was frankly embarrassing to do. It was a great idea, but AP should not have run it because they didn't have the goods to finish that story out. It was absurd to say only the people who saw the movie responded. They were obviously Gore fans, and one of them, Bob Carell, actually said, "I turned to Al when it was over," like he was at a private screening. So that was kind of humorous. But at any rate, I mean, I think that speaks for itself once again. So I don't have really any other questions on that.
I find myself forced now to read Seth's statement.
Sure, go ahead.
Okay, and this was edited by his or. Checked by his editors, so AP stands behind this as well.
I'm sure they do.
When I surveyed 102 scientists about the movie and book, The Inconvenient Truth, I chose who to ask using several techniques. First, as a reporter who has covered science, environment, and climate change for more than 15 years, I chose well more than four dozen experts who are considered tops in the field and who I've interviewed in the past, including several who work for the federal government. I included the panelists on the National Academy of Sciences' most recent scientific panel on climate change and the scientific participants in the American Meteorological Society / National Science Foundation climate change workshops that Bud Ward organized. I also included seven prominent skeptic scientists. Seven out of 102 is a proportion that many scientists tell me is an overrepresentation of skeptics in the climate science community. None of the skeptics responded that they had seen it. Some didn't respond. Richard Lindzen, who later wrote about the movie, did not respond to my query. Some skeptics had not seen it and commented, but I disregarded all comments from people who had not seen the movie. And finally, to include new voices, I surveyed the atmospheric science departments of prominent universities, Miami, Duke, Columbia, and Brown. As far as the Associated Press is concerned, as stated in a June press release, the AP considers the story simple, straightforward, and clean, and stands by its accuracy. The story reported facts and did not take a position in the debate.
Well, it was a good idea. It was good work. It did not come to fruition. It should not have.
But Mark, you don't want Seth to quote people about a movie that they haven't seen, do you?
No, but don't say scientists give Gore two thumbs up either. Say, you know, it's this the message that the scientists agree, 100% consensus, like the Naomi Oreskes study that Gore cites in the movie, and that's made a lot of the media rounds. I mean, these are flawed things that people do to try to say that everyone agrees and it's all over, when in fact, there's a lot of skepticism out there, and that's fine. You don't have to accept it. But all we're really saying today is don't label it. Don't call them Holocaust deniers. Don't call for Nuremberg trials. I guess what I'm saying is police your own. These are your journalists that are out there saying these things, and I still haven't heard anyone. I still want someone to comment on Scott Pelley. Can you say it, Andy? Say
you
something
are next.
About Scott Pelley.
Well, why don't we go to a next questioner right. here? And identify yourself, if you would.
Oh, there we go. Okay. All right. We shouldn't be comparing people who didn't deny or are skeptical. Oh, Tom Uhlsman, Center for Environmental Journalism. We shouldn't be comparing people who are skeptical of climate change to Holocaust deniers. That's just kind of silly. So there, I said it. All right. So now on to the real substance of what I wanted to say. Mark, you said before that, you know, this is a GOP press office, and that really gets at the gist of...
I clearly work for Senator Inhofe. Yeah.
Right, yeah. Okay, so my question is, the senator's critique of the media coverage is couched in the rhetoric of, you know, sound science. Let's look at sound science. But it's clear that what we're talking about here really has nothing to do with science. It has everything to do with politics and the politics of science. I think everybody in the room knows that. So tell us why we journalists in the room should actually take this and read this and take anything seriously that you have. Hold it. Let me ask my question. Anything that you have to say in here about science, since what it's really about is politics. If we're covering the science of climate change, why should we pay attention to this?
Because that includes quotes, statistics, and if you go on the web, links to scientific studies and scientific people. And also, this issue is not solely a science issue. It's obviously a political issue. Kyoto, what California's done. All of these things make it political. It's both. Senator Inhofe is obviously a politician, so he's going to cover the politics.
But as a reporter who's covering the science of the issue, give me a compelling reason why I should pay any attention to what you guys are saying.
Well, first of all, because it's not us saying it. We're talking about the scientists. We're presenting. We're trying. You know, obviously, he's a Senator Inhofe. It's not necessarily Senator Inhofe talking to the journalists, although it is a challenge to journalists. He's talking to the American people who, as I said, by the latest polling data, have had it with this kind of just the sky is falling, world is coming to an end, and it's not working for you guys, and I'm here to help you.
Thank you. Mark.
I'm Mark Schlefstein. I'm a reporter with the Times-Picayune in New Orleans.
Yes.
I like the climate porn idea. That's cute.
He's been using it for years.
However, I have to put it into context. And the context, unfortunately, is that in 2001, when I proposed to my newspaper that I do a story on the potential for a catastrophic storm flooding the city of New Orleans, it was dismissed as being disaster porn. So that's number one. And the reason I bring that up is because one of the things that continues to get lost in this debate that is going on between you and us and between the senator on the floor is that there are significant issues that are being considered by the Senate and the House right now about money to deal with effects of potentially climate change. They may be the result of what already has happened with climate change, but we're talking about sea level rise. And being in New Orleans, those two things are the Water Resources Development Act and the energy bill that has revenue sharing in it. And one of the results of the speech was that those were 2 hours more of House, you know, of floor debate that were not used to complete action on those two bills that would have provided us with more protection against the potential that the scientists were right.
I'm sorry, so what's your question?
Well, that's the question is, are you concerned that that might be where things are going, that we are getting so bogged down in this debate that the problems that we are facing today from issues that are being labeled as climate change are being ignored?
I mean, yeah. In fact, the best one to say would be Bjørn Lomborg's Copenhagen Consensus. He got top Nobel laureates together, and they ranked everything, and climate change is at the bottom in terms of looking at the world in terms of its priorities, whether you're talking about malaria or running water, electricity, and clean water and everything for the developing world. It doesn't rank. James Hansen. I'm not the moderator, but sorry.
you got it right.
Okay, I'm Jim Hansen. I'd like to correct the misimpression.
Closer to the mic a little bit, if you don't mind.
I'd like to correct the misimpression that Mark keeps leaving about relation to the Heinz Award. You know, in the 1980s, I spent a fair amount of time in Washington trying to draw attention to the global warming issue. And I met Senator John Heinz a few times. He's a Republican, by the way. And I told many of my friends that of all the people that I met in Washington, the most impressive one to me was John Heinz. And I agreed to go to his town hall meeting in Philadelphia when he talked about global warming. And he took a very open view. He was very interested in the economy and the economy of Pennsylvania. And so the other person who came to this town hall meeting was a skeptic. I don't remember his name, someone from MIT who did statistics. In any case, I do have a bias toward him because he called me at home one time and told me that he was protecting me from a fellow by the name of John Sununu, who was intent on getting me fired. And he told me that he had written a long letter on my behalf, and I have a copy, and he sent me a copy of that letter, and I still have it. That the Heinz Award you keep calling it a grant. It was an environmental award, which I believe was, I do not know who nominated me for the award, and I don't know how the selection works, but it's selected by a committee, and I don't know if Mrs. Heinz was on that committee or not, but it was not a grant, and
you did thank her personally, though, I think, when you had the...
Pardon?
You did thank her when you got the award, I recall, on the website. You said, thank you, Ms. Heinz. I mean, what I'm saying is...
I think that's a fairly normal thing to
sure,
do.
Sure, sure. It is, but don't act like she wasn't involved at all, that's all I'm saying.
The interesting thing was that she was told... When I told her about the letter I had from her husband, her former husband, it was complete news to her. And by the way, in every... I have a little one-paragraph introduction of myself that's used, and it mentions the Heinz Award.
Sure.
So there's no secret about that.
Yeah, it's not against you personally. I'll explain in a minute.
And by the way, I'm not a Democrat. I'm a registered independent. You can go to Pennsylvania and check if you like. My endorsement, as you which you call endorsement of John Kerry, was about as lukewarm as you can get. If you check that, I say that my favorite, who I wanted to vote for, is John McCain, partly because he put reform of what is the word?
Campaign finance.
Yeah, campaign finance reform at the top of his agenda, and he also put global warming very high on his agenda, and I criticized John Kerry for I felt he was politicizing the nuclear waste disposal problem, which I think should be a bipartisan. We should solve that problem. It's a technical problem which can be solved, and we shouldn't be politicizing it. But I said that I had the opportunity to speak to the current administration and try to make the case that the global warming is becoming very urgent, and they simply ignore the scientific evidence, in my opinion. And I said I thought there was a better chance that John Kerry would deal with the problem than the Bush administration. And that's why I said I was going to vote for John Kerry.
Sure.
But I think the way you cast this is a total misrepresentation of my actual position with regard to politics. I'm not a Democrat, and I'm not political, and I make my decisions on scientific basis.
And then when I said it's not personal, the only reason it's even relevant is because of people like Bill Blakemore, Miles O'Brien, Scott Pelley, who make media labeling an issue because they label Dick Lindzen for getting $10,000 in the 90s total, and because they label Pat Michaels, I don't think, and let me ask you, James Hansen, would you think Richard Lindzen would get away with getting money from a presidential candidate's wife and then endorsing him 4 years later? Do you think he would be able to go on without that being brought up endlessly in the media the way it is today?
An award, I don't understand why an award like that. I'm proud of that award.
Well, you should be proud.
And
I don't consider it,
and in no way does that influence my opinion scientifically. Or,
and you know what? I'm not saying that. I'm saying the media implies that Pat Michaels or someone else, it does influence, but somehow you're above it.
It would actually be misinformation to make that statement the way you do, because it would imply that I do have something that makes a bias.
I'm saying the media needs to play fair. It's not really about what you did. It's about the way the media portrays it. Somehow you're exempt from labeling, but the other side is the evil people, and that's what Bill Blakemore does.
No, I don't think so.
Tim, very quickly, we've got to get to
our
buses.
That's what it's about. But, yeah.
Okay, Mark, a question for you here. I'm trying to understand the equivalency of funding that comes from an industry that stands to lose its
sure.
place in the world and dollars and cents.
Good question.
And a political contribution. I don't think anybody ever asked Dick Lindzen what his political registration was or who he endorsed. Climate change is not necessarily a political issue. You have Republicans who are as concerned about climate change as anybody else. What's the what's the equivalency here when you're talking about labeling between...
Do you really...
Do you think that all Democrats think
I'm talking about environmental special interests, groups that get money. I gave out the budgets, a little Sierra Club, $91 million.
You made an issue of his speaking in favor of Kerry. I don't understand what the equivalency is between that and funding from industry.
The equivalent is he got a $250,000 grant from an environmental special interest group, essentially. They also funded environment 2004.
It's an award.
Well, you got $250,000. It's actually unrestricted. Yeah, you got $250,000 award. Fine, to use your terminology. I'm not going to dispute. I'm not going to get into that terminology. He got $250,000. End of story. And then he endorses the husband of that person. My point is, and the only point I'm bringing it up, is that I don't think Bill Blakemore, I don't think Miles O'Brien would let any scientific skeptic get away with that, as it looks like a conflict of interest. If you're labeling it, I'm not saying it's relevant. It's only relevant when you have Tom Brokaw do a two-hour special and have Michael Oppenheimer say, they're all bought and paid for, and then you have someone getting a $250,000. You get $250,000 from an environmental special interest, and then suddenly that's not news. No one mentions it. And then he endorses the husband, as I said. If Pat Michaels got $250,000 as an award from industry and then endorse the CEO's wife for state or for Senate, I think it would be a story. I think Bill Blakemore would be all over it. Go ahead.
I'm going to call it in because we have to go.
Is there a reason
places.
We have to stop? If people have to leave, they could just leave.
Why else do we have to leave. I have to leave.
Can I make one last point?
Yes, you may. Make it really super quick.
There's two different categories of stories to consider here, too. Stories on policy and stories on science. The great news about science is it's self-correcting. It's a juggernaut. It goes in one direction. And the peer review process eats away at the stuff that doesn't work, and it keeps moving. So that none of this is actually relevant to the science story at all. All of this, but all of this is relevant to the what do you do about it story. And Jim Hansen, a great scientist who's done great work that has won not just awards from environmental groups, but from many other things, his science gets judged on the basis of his science. He, as I wrote about a lot this year, when he takes off his NASA hat and starts talking about policy, then it's okay to talk about. You know, if he's going to have a view on what to do about it, that is a totally distinct question. And the scrutiny there should be higher, frankly. Not just for Jim, but for anybody who's in that realm. So I just think that it's important as you know, this is about the journalism. We're here. This is SEJ, right? It's journalists here, mostly. Remember, there's two categories of stories on this thing, what's going on in the world today. One is about the science, and one is about policy. And they have different rules. You should have much more labeling in the policy stories. The science will out, okay? The science is a no-brainer. It's easy.
And I just want to thank you. I just want to follow that up by saying that we're not the Washington Press Corps. This is a different animal, and I've been a political reporter, though not there. We don't generally do spin stories. We don't do those kinds of he said, she said, and think that that's somehow substantive in our beat. We deal with science, data, facts. If we're lucky, they're facts. Subject to revision down the line with the next study. But this is a major public policy issue. And the story that I would like to write is the story of Senator James Inhofe's Nixon in China moment when he becomes the guy that flips on this issue and leads the way on climate change response. I want to thank everybody for coming. Buses are leaving from the exhibition hall area at 7, right? 7.